Welcome to the official UEFA Champions League podcast and our mini-series Classic Matches. And today we look back at two of the most iconic finals in the competition's history.
First up, 1999 and Manchester United's remarkable late victory at the Camp Nou.
Beckham again with the corner kick. It's in! Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the comeback of comebacks.
We'll hear from the match winner Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Sir Alex Ferguson and Peter Schmeichel.
And Gareth Bale will help us relive the 2014 final, La Decima for Real Madrid.
And they are going again. Di Maria is going all the way into the middle and the shot hits Courtois and Gareth Bale has turned it in and scored for Real Madrid in extra time. It's Gareth Bale who might just have delivered La Decima.
Carlo Ancelotti and UEFA.com reporter Joe Walker reflect on that night in Lisbon on UEFA Champions League Classic Matches. Chris Parrott and myself, Rob Daly, are back again. Chris, a lot to get into this week. Why are we talking about these two games in particular then today? The 1999 final with Classic and 2014 as well.
Well, not just because they are fantastic finals, Rob, but both are being shown on UEFA TV this week. That is UEFA's OTT video platform. Fans just have to go to UEFA.tv or download the UEFA TV app on the Apple and Play stores. Log in or register and it's free to watch. So on Tuesday the 2nd of June, can't believe we're in June already, it's that incredible comeback for United against Bayern from 5pm CET, the whole game as live. Then on Wednesday the 3rd of June at the same time, it's that epic match between Real Madrid and their city rivals Atletico. Also, Rob, check out the Champions League official social media accounts over the coming days, because there's some great throwback content from the whole of the 2013-14 season. Loads of great goals, assists and moments.
Yeah, I think Zlatan Ibrahimovic's brilliant goal for Paris Saint-Germain against Anderlecht in there. Yaya Touré against Victoria Pilsen as well. Lots of great stuff on there. Well worth a look. So let's go. 21 years ago, Manchester United travelled to Barcelona in search of just their second European Cup title. Manchester United had just one European Cup at that point. Bayern were the opposition at Camp Nou. So let's set the pre-match scene a little bit, Chris.
Yeah, as you mentioned, United, it had been a long wait to be back in the European Cup final. They were going, Rob, for a historic treble. So in the English league, they just pipped Arsenal to the title on the final day. That was the 16th of May, 1999. 6 days later, they then beat Newcastle in the English FA Cup final, which meant the Champions League final on the 26th of May could crown a phenomenal 10 days in the club's whole history. 10 days, three finals, basically. And they'd already won two of them. And then check this out. They flew by Concorde to Barcelona. For those of you who can't remember Concorde, it was a supersonic jet, basically. It must have taken about 5 minutes. And actually, I think they had to fly from Manchester to London and then get on Concorde. Who knows why, but what a way to arrive. And their great goalkeeper, Peter Schmeichel, says, given this incredible period they'd had, actually, that was the perfect preparation for such a huge Champions League match.
We've already won two of the finals, so, and we haven't had time to celebrate or contemplate or anything. It's just another game we're playing. And I think it was, you know, we got hit by reality because we obviously didn't have Paul Scholes and Roy Keane available for that game. So the engine room was gone and we had to make too many chances for that to be comfortable. So the game probably became much harder than what we probably thought it would be.
Yeah, and worth noting, I think, Rob, that the Champions League final in 99 was Schmeichel's last game for United after 8 years of fairly incredible service. He wore the captain's armband because, as he mentioned, Keane was out. No Scholes either, both having picked up those yellow cards in United's amazing semi-final win over Juventus, which we chatted about, I think, on the first of this mini-series, Champions League Classic Matches.
So I think it's worth trying to paint the picture of what they had to do in central midfield. Now, it wasn't like they were completely bereft of options because Nicky Butt, around that time, obviously was a regular in the 11 for Manchester United. So Sir Alex Ferguson probably really had to do some rejigging to work out how to make a midfield that could combat Bayern.
Yeah, I think he did. And also remember, Manchester United really under Fergie, but particularly at this stage, were always 4-4-2. So he was never going to change the system in order to compensate for those big players missing. So He thought about playing Ryan Giggs at first in the middle, but then he went with David Beckham. I think the idea was to try and control the game a bit more with Beckham. So Giggs actually started on the right wing. We think of him as one of the best left wingers maybe to have certainly ever played in English football. Jesper Blomqvist kept his place in the semi-final on the left of midfield. And the other big decision was who would play centre-back, because Henning Berg was injured. So Ronny Jonsson took his spot. But Jaap Stam, who was a big player for United around this time, had been a bit of an injury doubt, but he was fit. So this was the United 11. Schmeichel in goal, Gary Neville right-back, Jonsson, Stam and Dennis Irwin completing the back four. Then Giggs, Butt, Beckham and Blomqvist. And up front, Andy Cole and Dwight York.
Bayern were also going for the treble. They had won the Bundesliga and had the DFB Pokal final, that's the German Cup final, 2 weeks later, which they would lose. They were looking to win this competition as well, the European Cup, for the first time since they won three in a row from 1974 to 1976. And at Camp Nou, they got off to a perfect start.
Effenberg and Basel are the two over the free kick. Basel wants this. And Basel puts Bayern in front. A fantastic start for the Germans.
It was my fear that we'd lose the first goal, because I watched the Bayern Kiev video several times, and when Bayern scored, they just locked up the game, and Kiev hadn't the mental strength to handle it. My fear was that they would do the same to us, but I also felt that we'd have far better mental strength than Kiev.
So Sir Alex Ferguson at this point is backing his side. So Chris, what was the flow of that first half? How did the game go after that early goal for Bayern?
It was a bit bitty, to be honest, Rob. There weren't too many clear-cut chances. I think as Sir Alex Ferguson, or just Alex Ferguson as he was known then, he hadn't got his knighthoods, alluded to it, that Bayern were kind of happy to then have Manchester United at arm's length. United had a couple of chances later on in the first period, but nothing for Oliver Kahn really to worry about. And Bayern deservedly went in at the break, 1-0 up. And as Peter Schmeichel testifies now, that performance in the first half wasn't deemed good enough in the United dressing room.
So Alex said at halftime, the way we play, we cannot win the trophy. And when you go up to the second half, the trophy's there. Have a look at it. Because that's the closest you'll get to it if you don't change your game and play better.
So Bayern definitely superior, Rob. 10 of their starting 11 that night were German as well, which I found interesting, that their only foreign player was Sami Kufur. So their 11 was Kahn in goal, an amazing back five, really. Marcus Babbel, Thomas Linker, the great Lothar Matthäus as the sweeper, Kufur and Michael Tarnap. Then Jens Jeremies and Stefan Effenberg as the central midfielders, Mario Basler and Alexander Zickler either side of the giant Carsten Janka. And proves that point of why they were happy to protect a lead, I think, not just with the likes of Matthäus, but when you've got Jeremies and Effenberg as an extra shield, Rob, I think it's unsurprising, really, that United, particularly in the first half, didn't really create much.
Well, Bayern did continue to rack up chances when you watch the game back. Mm. You know, I mean, United were creating chances as well. There was a great opportunity for Jesper Blomqvist. But I'd say Bayern had four great chances to make it 2-0. There was that Mehmet Scholl chip that hit the post. And then that remarkable moment where Janka hit the bar with an overhead kick in the 85th minute. And that surely would have won him.
When I saw it hit the bar and it came straight back to me, I knew we were going to win. I knew that we were not going to... At least we're not going to concede any more goals. That's the kind of feeling you have. You know, it's unscientific. It can't be proved. But it gives you something extra. It gives you confidence. It gives you belief that, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, there's nothing scientific about that. Peter Schmeichel couldn't have known that they would go on to win at that point. And I don't know. I don't know if many Manchester United fans, Chris, believe they were going to get back into the game.
I don't think so, because Bayern had been so dominant. You know, we've mentioned there twice they hit the woodwork, but Effenberg had a big chance as well, which Schmeichel saved. And really, you know, if anyone was going to get the second goal of the game, it looked like it was going to be Bayern. And Sir Alex Ferguson agrees with that sentiment. Here he is speaking post-match, so straight after the final in 1999, about how he felt at 1-0 down going into the closing stages.
Yeah, I was stunned. I was starting to... adjust to losing the game, and I kept saying to myself, well, just remember, keep your dignity and accept it's not your year. But football's such a funny game, you never know, and It's a fairy tale, really.
I love hearing that audio back from the actual time. Okay, so let's cut to the chase, Chris. Let's get to the real drama. United had thrown on a couple of subs. Teddy Sheringham and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer by this point. So it's the first minute of added time now. So still 1-0 to Bayern. And of course, the goalkeeper has to come up for it too.
They had read us, so they knew exactly how to mark us. But when I come up, there's an unknown element there. So who's gonna mark him? And that little bit of confusion is what you're looking for. Little bit of confusion. And I'm unmarked. I mean, I get a little touch in the ball, but because I'm there, someone else has to come over. And that leaves Dwight to get the ball in the back still.
In by Becker. Schmeichel's up there. York can't get anything on that. And they've got an equalising goal. Teddy Sheringham. They couldn't have left it any later. An incredible conclusion.
I love it when a goalkeeper comes up for a corner, Chris, especially in a Champions League final. It was chaos in there.
It was. And you know what? The fact it was Schmeichel as well, who has scored a European goal against Rota Volgograd from memory. And he also scored, I think, later on in his career against Everton. Was
for
it?
Villa.
For Aston Villa.
Yeah,
for Villa.
Yeah.
So this was a guy who clearly fancied himself as a centre forward as well. And yeah, I mean, you heard it there. And having watched it back, he is right, because something happened in that Bayern penalty area where, having looked very settled and safe, all of a sudden it was pretty chaotic, wasn't it?
It was crazy as well, the four strikers United had at the time. So you had York and Cole as your undisputed front two. Then you had Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, one of the great super subs of the Premier League era. And then you had Teddy Sheringham. That was only, actually, his fifth goal of the season, which is hard to believe as well.
Yeah, for a player of such quality. And I think for me, one of the defining moments, and if you watch it back on UEFA TV, it's worth looking for, is Lothar Matthäus, who had come off, sitting on the bench, looking completely shocked when United equalised. And, you know, Matthäus is one of the best defensive players probably to have ever played the game. I don't think that's overstating it, but he has never won the Champions League. He's won the World Cup. He's won the UEFA European Championship. So this was his moment near the end of his career to lift this trophy. And he must have thought he was going to. And then all of a sudden, United snatched it away. But at this stage, it was only 1-1, of course. So it was still very much game on. And you wonder what on earth Matthäus was thinking when this happened just a couple of minutes later.
Beckham again with the corner kick. It's in! Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the comeback of comebacks. Manchester United with that goal, surely now, have won the UEFA Champions League. Two corner kicks, two delicate touches, and enough to deliver the trophy to Manchester United. Surely now there's no way back for Bayern.
I was just so concentrated. I didn't really think too much about the consequence of that goal. Obviously, in the time gone since, you sit back and you meet so many people. It's been the best night of their lives, many have said. And of course, you look back at it yourself, it's probably the highlight of my career. But then again, at the moment, you didn't think that way. You just thought, I'd done my job.
Well, Solskjaer, of course, the current Manchester United manager there, Rob. And I mean, when that goal went in, it was pure chaos in the stands. And there are some incredible images of... Do you know what? I almost think in any Champions League final, this might have been the one where that complete contrast between desolation and delight was so obvious. The Bayern players slumped to the floor. Peter Schmeichel was doing cartwheels at the other end of Camp Nou. It was complete pandemonium in the Manchester United end. I think perfectly illustrated by this story from Schmeichel.
I had friends, and my friends were sat in the corner, and actually where the corner was taken from. And they tell me stories about their celebration. That celebration was crazy. They went and they were hugging everybody and kissing people they've never met in their life. And, you know, and one of my friends, he was like that. And then he realized, oh, game's not finished yet. And he looks around and he's in the middle of the stadium. He's in the middle of the stadium. And he must have hugged 200 people. And when the game actually ended up, he was far away from everybody else. And, you know, it's just one of those things. People just went crazy, absolutely crazy.
Terrific, Rob. I love that from Schmeichel. And you know what? I was thinking this the other day, okay? So there was probably 90,000 in Camp Nou. And if you did find yourself 200 metres away from your friends, it's not like now where everyone has their mobile phones. It's the sort of thing that you could be lost for hours just celebrating on your own.
Well, there were a lot of people getting in the mix in the celebrations, really, at the end of the game for United.
Yeah, there were. Another part of that interview for UEFA that Schmeichel did a few years ago, actually, is he recalls how they were celebrating in the dressing room. And all of a sudden, his son, Kasper Schmeichel, now Denmark and Leicester City's goalkeeper, and Charlie Sheringham, Teddy's son, all of a sudden turned up. And to this day, they have no idea how they evaded all of the security and made their way through the Warren of Camp Nou to get into the dressing room.
Well, maybe 20 years ago, it wasn't as tight as it is now, you know.
And their reward, Rob, was basically those two then kids being in all of the photos in the dressing room.
Oh, good on them. Well, let's give the final word to Sir Alex Ferguson, should we? Seems only right, on what it meant to win the Champions League and what has gone down as the club's greatest ever season.
We had to risk to try and get back in the match. At the end of the day, it's hard for me to take it in. I simply don't know where to begin in the sense how these things happen. But I'm really proud of my players. I'm proud of my heritage. I'm proud of what my family have given me, all my life. And it's the greatest moment of my life today. I think on Sir Matt Busby's birthday, I think he was doing a lot of kicking up there.
Yeah, lovely moment there, Chris, and referencing Busby. I think it's probably worth explaining for younger fans especially why that was such a significant thing to say.
Yeah, and to have the calmness in that moment after the finish we've talked about to also, you know, compose yourself and come up with those nice words. So that was talking about Sir Matt Busby, who had died 5 years before United's triumph in Barcelona, arguably the most important man in Manchester United's history. In 1968, he led United to their first European Cup when they beat Benfica at Wembley. But I mentioned this on the last podcast, actually, as well. 10 years before that, he had survived the Munich air disaster, remarkably so, was terribly injured in that tragic accident that cost 8 of the Manchester United squad their lives. So Sir Matt Busby then, you know, rebuilt United and took them to the very top of the European game. So his legacy still lives on to this day. And it certainly, as you heard there from Ferguson, was in everybody's thoughts in 99 after they beat Bayern.
OK, so a reminder of how you can watch that game on UEFA.tv this week. Tuesday, the 2nd of June, the incredible comeback for United against Bayern at 5 p.m. CET. Plenty more to come on UEFA Champions League Classic Matches. Let's go forward 15 years in time now to the 2014 final, an All Madrid meeting in Lisbon. UEFA.com reporter Joe Walker is on the way, as well as Carlo Ancelotti, who was Real Madrid's head coach for this one. But Chris, let's try and set up the game first of all.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a big rarity, Rob. It was just the second all-Spanish final, but probably more importantly, the first ever final between two teams from the same city. Real Madrid, you remember, were going for La Décima, the 10th in Spanish. So a 10th European title, which had pretty much been an obsession ever since they won their 9th 12 years before in 2002. They had Cristiano Ronaldo, who was blistering that season. He had 16 goals coming into the final, which is still an extraordinary amount to have scored in one single Champions League campaign. Atletico, though, were reborn, really, under Diego Simeone. They had just won their first La Liga title since the mid-90s, and were in their first European Cup final for 40 years, Rob. So it was very much a team coming of age in the mould of their head coach Simeone. But I think the big build-up to the game really was all about whether they would select Diego Costa or not.
Yeah.
Because in the final league game, he picked up a hamstring injury. Now, he was picked, but he didn't last that long.
OK, here's a reminder of how this game unfolded, with a little help telling the story from goalscorer Gareth Bale.
Here it comes from Gabby, the corner from the right. Referred to Koke to take this one as they alternate responsibilities. Back in by Juanfran. Goalkeeper Casillas has come, hasn't got there and can't claw it back up the line. The looping header back towards goal. Diego Godin with another potentially priceless goal for Atletico.
We always were praying that we get a goal and we left it late, but that's the type of team they are. They like to defend very solidly and not give you too much space.
Luka Modric with a ball. There's the header. There is the equalising goal. Real Madrid have done it.
Sergio Ramos has got the goal again for Real Madrid. Deep, deep into added time in the final. There has been an incredible twist in Lisbon.
We kept grinding away and grinding away, got that goal that we needed, and I think that gave us the momentum then to go on and win.
And they are going again. Di Maria is going all the way into the middle, and the shot hits Courtois, and Gareth Bale has turned it in and scored for Real Madrid in extra time. It's Gareth Bale who might just have delivered La Decima. Real Madrid 2 and Atletico 1.
Yeah, I think it happens in football. You have some of them days where you just miss a few chances, but I think the most important thing is you don't let it hit your confidence, and just keep going, keep trying, keep shooting, and thankfully one went in the end.
Marcello's running forward into the penalty area. Good save by Courtois, but it's gone in, and that is that. And Real Madrid are champions of Europe again. Cristiano Ronaldo, who won it, will take it. And Cristiano Ronaldo sets the seal on a stunning night for Real Madrid. On his return to Lisbon, he writes his name further into Real Madrid legend at the end of another record-breaking season for the champions of Europe. It's Real Madrid 4, Atletico 1.
A dream come true, literally. I think when you're a little boy, you dream of lifting the Champions League, and to lift the 10th one for Real Madrid is special, and one that will go down in history.
It is raised by Iker Casillas, and Real Madrid, a dozen years since last lifting the UEFA Champions League, Real Madrid are kings of the competition again. A 10th European Cup realises the dream of La Decima, and the celebrations start here.
Well, now we can speak to UEFA.com reporter Joe Walker, who covers both Real Madrid and Atletico in many of their battles since the 2014 final. Joe, pleasure to have you on the show. I think it's probably worth, you know, at this point, just explaining the rivalry a little bit between these clubs, because on a global scale, of course, the Clásico and Real Madrid-Barcelona's rivalry is well known. What is that city rivalry like between those two clubs?
Hi, Rob. Well, yeah, it's probably a podcast in itself, to be honest, talking about the rivalry, so I'll try and keep it concise. Basically, it's completely a city divided, really. The rivalry is very friendly. There's their spice when they meet, but there's a lot of families who maybe the dad is a Real Madrid fan, the mum's an Atletico fan, and vice versa. You know, you see, it's really common to see couples wearing different shirts and then go to the game together. So it's a friendly rivalry in all senses, but at the same time, you can't take away the fact there is a big rivalry between the two sides. And Atletico Madrid fans like to think of themselves as representing the city's working class. Of course, the old Vicente Calderon Stadium was in a very humble part in the south of Madrid, just on the banks of the River Manzanares, whereas the Real Madrid fans are a bit more brash, they're a bit more in your face, you know, the kind of the cool kid with the designer haircut and flashy trainers at school, if you like. And their stadium is in the heart of the city's wealthy financial district as well. So I think you can kind of define it as that, really, if we're given a limited amount of time.
I imagine by that description, you must be the Real Madrid supporter then, Joe.
Well, anyone who's seen my hair would probably disagree.
I mentioned at the top that this was their first final since the 70s Atletico, which also ended in heartbreaking fashion when they led Bayern and then Bayern equalised and it went to a replay and they lost that final. How badly did this defeat hurt Atletico, do you think?
Unfortunately, I wasn't at the game at the time, but I did watch it in an apartment block where you kind of heard a lot of screams throughout the game, and especially when the equalising goal from Sergio Ramos went in. And it really did hurt Atletico fans, I think, because although they like to call themselves El Pupas, which means the cursed one, literally in Spanish, and they kind of revel in the fact that, you know, the odds are always against them and how they managed to kind of snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, if you like, throughout their history. It really must have hurt them because they were seconds away from beating their eternal rivals to a European Cup, which turned out to be the 10th one for Real Madrid. So to be the side who were beaten by Real Madrid to win their 10th one is something that I don't think that they will ever live down, no matter how long and how successful they are as a club.
Looking at that Atletico side that started the final, so Courtois in goal, then Juanfran, Miranda, Godin, Felipe Luis, then Raul Garcia, Thiago, Gabi, Koke midfield, and Villa, Diego Costa, of course, came off after 9 minutes of the final up front. They had won the title and that brilliant result at Barcelona to secure the title that season, Joe, but do you think that was the best team that Diego Simeone has assembled during his quite long, let's face it, quite long reign now as Rojiblanco's head coach?
yes to a certain extent and no to another. So yes to the extent of they won the league, and you can't really grumble at the fact that a side who's gone, you know, it's 38 league games to go and lift the title, you have to say that they're a team who are the best that Diego Simeone has ever assembled. It wasn't pretty, as I think everyone who can remember them would attest to. That midfield, as you've just named, is very industrial. You know, you've got your Raul Garcia, your Gabby. You got up front, you know, David Villa and Diego Costa, who, while being brilliant goal scorers and who get you a lot of points, they're also very workmanlike. You know, they're tireless, they'll chase down, they'll run the channels. Whereas I think that the 2016 team was also, unfortunately for Atletico Madrid, came against Real in the final. They were a bit more easy on the eye, I'd say, when Antoine Griezmann started to blossom. You had the likes of Yannick Carrasco operating on the wing instead of, you know, Gabby, who kind of operated as a makeshift right midfielder despite being a defensive central midfielder. So I think that for me, the better side and aesthetically was the 2016 one, but you can't really make any kind of argument against the 2014 side being the best one.
Joe, we had the slightly strange scenario of both teams then flying back to Madrid. One, of course, devastated, the other completely delighted. Can you just talk a bit about the celebrations in Madrid? Because I understand, and I've spoken to you many times about it off air, but the fact that both clubs have their part of Madrid where they traditionally go to celebrate any successes.
Yeah, so there's, just for people who might not know, there's a big long road that kind of goes through the heart of Madrid called La Castellana, and there are two big fountains in the middle of roundabouts there. So one is called Plaza de Cibeles, which is where Real Madrid celebrate, and one is Plaza Neptuno, which is where Atletico celebrate. And as I mentioned before, you know, Real Madrid fans are, they're not shy, they're not great losers, and they maybe would be described as not great winners by some Atletico fans because of the way that they would be very happy to sort of rub it in your face a little bit, the fact that they've won. And I can remember being in the area of Cibeles once Real Madrid had won that decima, and they were very happy to let you know that they'd won. They were very happy to point out to anybody walking down the street wearing an Atletico Madrid shirt that they'd just been beaten. It's one of those things where Real Madrid, you know what you're getting with them. They are the way they are. They're proud of it, and it's worked for them, and it works for their fans as well.
The side that day was Casillas in goal, then Coen Trout, left-back, Varane, Ramos, Carvajal, midfield three of Modric, Khedira, Di Maria, who was a man of the match and sensational in that role on the day, and then the front line, of course, of Ronaldo, Benzema and Bale. And if you're wondering, well, Marcelo, where's Marcelo? He came on in the game to score that goal in extra time. What did it mean to that team, Joe, to win that 10th title? Because I suppose for normal clubs, 12 years without a European Cup isn't that long, really.
unless you're Real Madrid. The great irony is that they won that one and then they went on to win and win and win and win again. So it really was the monkey off their back. It became an obsession for the club. And I think especially once you get to number nine, the desperation to win number 10 just becomes a bit greater. But as we saw throughout the year, there was 12 years where Real Madrid got through a huge number of head coaches. You know, we saw the Galactico team come and go. Then they tried to operate on a more, you know, Spanish policy, and it took, you know, even the great Jose Mourinho couldn't get them past the semi-final stage. It took Carlo Ancelotti to come in with his unique style of man management and the way he was able to balance a side out that, you know, that you just mentioned, Angel Di Maria there. It also contained Gareth Bale, who for all intents and purposes is a very similar player to Di Maria, but he managed to get them both in the same team. And of course you've got the likes of Cristiano Ronaldo and Karim Benzema to fit in there as well. So it was very important for Real Madrid, of course. And, well, it can't be disputed that Carlo Ancelotti was just the right man in the right place at the right time. And then if you look as well, when Rafa Benitez took over from him, things fell apart very quickly as well, just a year later. So it took a very special coach to get the job done. That job's obviously been continued incredibly by Zinedine Zidane, who was, of course, Carlo Ancelotti's assistant on the day.
Yeah, do you think Zidane has taken much of what he learned from Ancelotti? I remember watching in extra time, both of them were on the touchline barking out orders, and it was interesting to see that, because I think at that stage we knew Zidane was going to be Real Madrid coach at some point. But do you think he learned a lot from Ancelotti?
Yes, I do. Well, I mean, of course, the thing that you have to factor in that Zinedine Zidane has above many, many other coaches in world football is that he was one of the best football players in the history of the game. So he's automatically got that respect. When he walks into a dressing room, you know, you see it in press conferences, he walks in and there's just an aura about him. And I think that that's very much the main sort of building blocks, the foundations of his management, is that he knows that when he talks, players will listen. But you also have to know how to manage a dressing room. And I think that he's taken a lot from Ancelotti in that sense. You see Zidane and you hear about his style of management, and it's sort of hands-off compared to a lot of other elite-level coaches. I'm not saying that one way is right or the other way is wrong, but he's not too on top of his players. And I think that the players like the fact that he will let them almost do what they want to a certain extent, but when he talks, they do very much listen.
Gareth Bale, of course, Joe, we heard from him there. It was his debut season, of course, after that huge transfer fee to take him from Spurs to Madrid. What was it like around the time around Gareth Bale and the thoughts of Real Madrid fans for him? Of course, he's gone on to score in further Champions League finals for Real Madrid. But just what a tremendous day for him, you know, because we don't really see many Brits abroad go and do the business in La Liga and that. And it was a remarkable, remarkable day for Gareth Bale.
Yeah, it was. And I think that a lot of people forget that it also came hot on the heels of a goal, a stunning solo goal in the Copa del Rey final when played against Barcelona, where if you kind of just cast your minds back, he actually ran off the pitch as he took on despairing diving Mark Bartra, just trying to take him down before slotting in to win the game for Real Madrid. And that was a Real Madrid without Cristiano Ronaldo on the day as well. So I think that that was a very special day for him. And then that kind of gave him the momentum going into the game against Atletico to go and be decisive. And as Gareth himself said, he did have quite a number of chances during the game as well. I think a lot of people might not remember the circumstances of the game because of how it unfolded. It was so dramatic at the end. But Real Madrid, they missed a lot of chances during the 90 minutes. I think that Atletico maybe took their one clear-cut chance, and that necessarily wasn't even that clear-cut chance, whereas Real Madrid missed a lot, and Gareth Bale was quite culpable in that. But then that's what great players do, isn't it? They just don't allow the pass to affect them, and they get on with the things in hand. And he was in the right place at the right time to head in what was ultimately the goal that won the game, because I think once Real Madrid went 2-1 up, there was only ever going to be one winner.
Yeah, and of course Ronaldo back in Portugal was, you always felt he was going to score at some stage, and he got the final one for his 17th goal of the season in the Champions League, Joe, which when I say that, I can barely believe he got 17 in one Champions League season. Do you think 13, 14 was peak Ronaldo, or is that impossible to say given what he's gone on to achieve?
Yeah, thanks for that one, Chris. I think it, I mean, I'm not, I might be getting splinters in my behind here from sitting on the fence, but I think it's quite hard to ever to say which season was peak Ronaldo, because he had so many amazing, incredible seasons, you know, at Manchester United and at Real Madrid. And then you just also have to look at what he's now currently doing at Juventus as well. I think he's 35 years of age. You know, he's incredible. That season, of course, he set new heights in the Champions League, and his performance away in Munich against Bayern in the semi-final was just one of the best performances you'll ever see in the competition against a side led by Pep Guardiola, who fancied themselves as one of the favourites to win the competition. So it was perhaps peak Ronaldo, but I wouldn't put too much on that one, because I'm sure he himself would probably say peak Ronaldo started in the early 2000s and is still continuing now.
I think you're right. Joe, thank you very much for joining us to discuss Real Madrid Atletico.
No worries at all, guys.
Okay, Chris, I think we should finish by hearing from Carlo Ancelotti. What an achievement to win the Champions League with another club. But he had huge admiration for his opposite number in the Atletico dugout.
I spoke with him. I congratulated him before the game to win the league, and after the game, the same. Of course, you have to respect of the team that doesn't win but fight all the time. Atletico deserved to play this final, but I think at the end, we deserve to win.
Quite rightly there, Carlo Ancelotti acknowledging the great work that Diego Simeone did. And Chris, the two clubs would then, in extraordinary circumstances, with Simeone still as head coach, be intertwined for the next few years in Champions League football. I mean, the season after they met in the Champions League final, they played each other 8 times in Spanish Super Cup, La Liga, Copa del Rey, and of course in the Champions League again.
Yeah, remarkable and difficult not to feel sorry for Atletico, that their golden period really ran simultaneously with Real Madrid's supreme period, where basically they were unstoppable. So
yeah,
2014, the final we're talking about, they lost, of course. The next season, they were beaten in the quarterfinals by Real Madrid. Then in 2016, they were beaten on penalties in the final in Milan by Real Madrid. And Cristiano Ronaldo, most of the time, was the guy who scored the goals against them. And then a year later, they were knocked out in the semi-finals by Real Madrid. And that was the second leg of that game. I was lucky enough to be at the Calderon, and it was the final home European game there. And they went 2-0 up, having lost the first leg 3-0. And you thought, is this going to be the fairy tale finish for this iconic stadium? And of course, the answer was no, because Real Madrid scored an away goal, and that was it. So remarkable. And I think that just comes back to Joe's comment there. What did he say? He said the fans like to call themselves the curse. And you can't help but feel after this 2014 final and the subsequent run that, my word, they must be even more sick of their city rivals. Imagine having your best period as a club, really, and then consistently, basically the only games you lose are in heartbreaking fashion to one of your great rivals.
Okay, next, Chris and I are going to try and pick a dream team from all four sides that we've discussed so far. Okay, Chris, as we always do on this podcast, we now have to select a dream team from the two finals, the four teams involved. We've picked our 11s, and we're trying to do it roughly on how they played in the final, or certainly around that era of the side. This was really hard this week. I had no idea what to do.
Yeah,
I've got Schmeichel in goal.
Yeah.
I knew that.
No, exactly. And do you know why I think it was hard? It's because for 89 minutes, Bayern were the best team in 1999 and lost. And then in 2014, for 92 minutes or whatever it was, I think Atletico were the better team. So it's really difficult then to, normally I think, well, who are the winners? I'll pick the most from those. But actually on this occasion, all four teams were actually, I think, over the course of their finals, they were pretty evenly matched.
I've just changed one of my players after you said that. Okay. All right, let's I'm just wavering. All right, so Schmeichel in goal. What's your back four, Chris?
My back four is, I've gone Gary Neville right back.
Yeah.
Sergio Ramos and Diego Godin as the centre halves. And then even though he only came on in the 59th minute, I've gone Marcelo left back because he was the catalyst really for Madrid's turnaround, I think, in Lisbon.
Chris, we got the same back five.
We have not.
This keeps happening. We have Schmeichel, Neville, Ramos, Godin, Marcelo. Is that what you put?
Yeah, that's what I've got, yeah.
All right, so, okay. God, we're boring, aren't we? So, so what about your midfield three? I've done a bit of cheating here, I think, with the way I've set up the team. How many midfielders you got? Four?
No, I've gone three. I've gone 4-3-3.
Okay.
I quite like this midfield, if it played together, I think. I've gone Beckham, Di Maria, and Effenberg.
Oh, I just took Beckham out for Effenberg. So I've got Di Maria. I mean, that central midfield performance, we didn't discuss it much, but people can see it when they rewatch the final, just how good he was in that role and how he's
so good.
Yeah. So Di Maria, Effenberg, and I put Basler in there in the midfield three. I've lost my way, Chris. I just wanted to get to the front line, if I'm being honest.
Well, did you know what? I've put Basler in my front three.
Okay, yeah, that's good. He was in the front three for Bayern that day, so that's allowed.
But I also can't say anything because I put Paolo Maldini at right back last week. So
you did, yeah.
So anything goes. So my front three is I have got Basler and Bale either side, and this is controversial.
Don't you dare put Ronaldo up front.
No, I put Sheringham up front.
Lovely.
Do you want to know why? Because I know he only came on, but given it's their performances in the final, he did get a goal and he got that assist.
See, I didn't know what to... So I got Bale and Ronaldo because, I mean, Ronaldo was mad around that time. He didn't have a tremendous final, in truth. But and then I've actually gone for Andy Cole. I've completely unravelled here, Chris. I was like, Andy Cole was so good around that time. I don't know what I've done with this. I don't know what I've done. Schmeichel, Neville, Ramos, Godin, Marcelo, Di Maria, Effenberg, Basler, Bale, Ronaldo, Cole. It's still pretty good. It's a good team.
Yeah, it's not bad. Schmeichel, same back five then, and I've just gone Beckham, Di Maria, Effenberg, Basler and Bale either side of Teddy Sheringham, or as the great Brian Clough used to call him, Edward Sheringham.
And I just noticed as well, neither of us have gone for Solskjaer.
Yes, this is true.
Is that criminal? I don't know if that's a bad thing that we've done.
Probably, and probably next time I'm working at Old Trafford, I'll look round and see the Solskjaer banners and the song will be heard when fans are back and think maybe I should have put him there.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. I think the fact that Sheringham got the goal and the assist puts him just ahead of Ollie.
Yeah, it was tough this week. Okay, so let us know what you think. What would make up your 11 from those four teams? Tell us on Twitter at Champions League, hashtag UCL Classics. Okay, Chris, so let's have a reminder of how you can watch these two amazing finals in full on UEFA.TV.
Yeah, on Tuesday, it is Manchester United against Bayern from 5 p.m. CET. And then on Wednesday this week, Real Madrid against Atletico at the same time. And if you miss them this week, don't worry, they're loaded onto UEFA TV. You can watch them forever. Simply go to UEFA.TV or download the app on the Apple and Play stores and log in or register. They are free to watch. And also, Rob, keep an eye on the Champions League's official social media channels over the coming days. Loads of great moments, goals, assists from the whole of the 2013-14 campaign, which of course, as we've discussed, ended with Real Madrid winning La Decima.
Okay, if you enjoy the show, please leave us a review on your podcast provider, and we'll be back next week to preview two more UEFA.TV games, classics from the Champions League. But for now, from Chris Parrott and myself, Rob Daly, it's goodbye.